This is Youth Conference California 2013. Our speaker is Brother Jim Stiles, and his topic for this series is Return of the Exiles. Brother Jim?
Well, I hope you like having two project sessions in a row. Hopefully, once you got working on your projects, you can just keep right on rolling that next period and just look at how much you got done this morning. That's good. You gonna have anything left to do for the rest of the week? Are you all finished? Oh no, we got more things you can work on. What I wanna do this class is we're gonna move into Zechariah's visions. And first of all, though, I wanna finish up a couple things from Haggai that we never got to, but for those of you that are working on Haggai, it might be helpful to read the rest of the story. I gave you some hints, at least, as to what it might mean. But in Haggai chapter, you know, we looked at all those exhortational lessons that came out of the fact that consider how your life has been going, and then make some decisions based on that. How have you really been doing economically? How are things really going in relation to what God had done in the land? And making sure you listen to God when he talks to you through economics and health issues and things like that today. He's trying to grab our attention as he did with these people. In chapter 2, Haggai goes on and says that, look at your temple. This temple that some of you despise, the day of small things, and you're all worried about this temple that you're building right now and not being as glorious as Solomon's temple. He predicts that God will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all the nations, and they will come to the desire of all nations. And what he's predicting is that this temple that you're building, I'm going to shake the earth again anyways, and it's all going to be redone. So don't worry about your temple right now. Do the best you can with what you have, and realize that in the future, there's going to be a time in which an even better temple will be built, and it will be established, and it will be the desire of all the nations, because all the nations are going to come to this temple. Not just Jews, but all the nations will come, and I'll fill this temple with glory, says the Lord. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine. You see, that's what we have to remember about all this stuff out there today. God owns the economics of the world. He owns the lands. He owns the health issues. And he can decide to give it to whomever he wills. And if he wants you to have a lot of money, he'll give it to you. If you're doing the right things and he finds out he can entrust you with it, it's not that you've got to go out and make sure it happens. He will provide you with what you need. And he'll make sure in your ecclesias that you have enough finances coming in for the projects he wants done. It's not a case where I've got to go out there and spend all my life doing it and making all this and giving up all my time for economic reasons and then somehow justify that, well, I'll give part of it to God. What he wants us to do is be involved in his work, and he'll take care of the rest. Or as verse 9 says, that the glory of this latter temple. Now, you might want to look at that in terms of your versions, because most versions actually put something like that in there. The King James and the New King James do. But the NASB caught the real spirit of it, as some of the expositors explain. He's not talking about the glory of this latter temple and saying that the glory of this temple is going to be better than Solomon's. He says that the latter glory of this temple. There's going to be a day in which his house will be here, and the latter glory of this temple is going to be greater than the former right now. And it's okay. It's not a comparison between this temple and Solomon's. It's a comparison between the latter glory of the temple God will put together when he shakes the nations, and it will be better than the greater glory than this former one right now. And in this place, he says, I will give peace. So he intends to build another one. And then Haggai ends up with this little section in chapter 2 about an explanation of a typical ritual of the law, and helps them understand, like, what I like about this is it helps us realize when you're reading the law in the Old Testament today, like, some people wonder, like, why do we even bother reading it? We're not under the law anymore. We don't have to keep the law anymore. What's the purpose of reading the law? Well, the point is that we can still gain the exhortational lessons that those people were supposed to get. And so he concludes his prophecy then with this little section in chapter 2. On the 24th day of the ninth month in the second year of Darius, the word of the Lord came by Haggai the prophet, saying, thus says the Lord of hosts, now, ask the priests concerning the law. So go to those priests that know the law really well and ask them and say, if somebody carries meat in the fold of his garment, So what they used to do is they would take meat. They didn't have dishes like we do today. So they would take the meat and they put it into the fold of their garment. They pull their garment up and they'd be carrying it around like this. And they'd carry it from one place to another in the fold of their garments. That way, I guess you didn't have to touch that hot boiled meat. They didn't have pot holders back then. So you'd put it in there and hold it, and you could carry it from one place to another. And this is what priests would do when they would take the meat out of the pots or the roasted things. And this is how they would carry them. So if one carries holy meat in the fold of his garment, and with the edge he touches bread or stew or wine or oil or any food. So you're walking along, you walk over by the food table, you're going to put it down, and you just happen to catch the bread as you're going by. Now, this is holy meat. This is holy meat. And so if you do happen to touch the bread or something else on the table when you go to put the meat down, they said, will the other stuff become holy? In other words, does holiness sort of like transfer right over to the other guy? And the priests answer, and they say, no. That's based on Leviticus 6. They were told that that isn't what happens. Then he said, all right, ask him another question. If one who is unclean because of a dead body, so if you went to a funeral or somebody and you touched the body, or what if somebody died in your house and you had to like be involved in carrying them out, or you in some way you've come in contact with a dead body, so you become ritualistically unclean. You're by the law, you're unclean that day. You had to go through procedures where you wash and you wouldn't be clean until the next day. So if you're unclean because of a dead body and you touch any of that stuff on the table, all right, now will it become unclean? In other words, can you transfer uncleanness? And the priest answered and he said, it shall be unclean. That was the rules of the law. Now, why did God write the law like that? Why did he put those details in there about the differences between transferring cleanness and uncleanness? What was the point? And then Haggai goes on and says, so it is with this people. And so is this nation before me, says the Lord. And so is every work of their hands. And what they offer, there is unclean. And what God was trying to teach through the law to all of us is that he wants us to understand that it's very easy to be influenced by uncleanness. Uncleanness transfers so simple. You know, somebody does something wrong. Somebody comes up with an idea and you watch it and you listen and you find out, ooh, I'd sort of like to do that too. And it just sort of transfers. It's sort of like contagious amongst the community. But that's not the way holiness is. Our brains are so against holiness, we don't really want to go that route. Somebody comes up with a great idea and something that we can do in our families and our ecclesias and maybe like holding to one of God's standards, and our brain's reaction is, I don't really want to do that. I mean, that's not really fun for me and for my body. And so the unclean things by nature are just easier to transmit to other people. And that's what he wanted them to see in their law. And so that's why Haggai brings it up. And he says, look, that's the way this people is. You've been very good at transferring your uncleanness. You spread it out amongst you all. And it's very difficult to retrain. You're going to have to work at this. That's why the Apostle Paul would write later on and say to train yourself in godliness. You have to train yourself in godliness. For why bodily training is of some value, godliness is of value in every way, because it holds the promise of the life to come. And that saying is sure and worthy of acceptance. Now, all of you guys know, maybe some of you girls, you know, you go to the gym, you lift weights, right? Get those good guns on the arms, right? I used to watch my sons go through this. They build up their bodies and they do all this training for like 3 months. They train until they could have that and a six pack over here, and you do all that stuff, right? And then they go to Hawaii for a couple of weeks or something like that, or you go on vacation somewhere, or you get sick and you can't go to the gym. You realize what happens in like just 2 or 3 weeks? You start to lose it all. It just disappears so fast. And yet you got to train and train and train to build it back up again day after day. And I know all those guys that have tried this. You all know this, you know. I used to watch at a gathering one time. Some guys thought when they were at a gathering or on vacation, they could cheat. They'd buy these little machines they could hook up to their muscles that would like work their muscles while they're sitting there, and they'd shake away. And they thought, well, that was going to keep it up for them. You know, they're showing electric charges down and make their muscles contract and relax like that. So you get a workout while you're sitting there if you don't mind the shaking. And that's the kind of thing people go through in order to keep those muscles there. But what Paul's trying to warn us about is that, look, in the same way that you learn about training those muscles and you can build up your bodies like that, That's the way we have to approach godliness. And one of them has value for this life. The other one has value for the life to come. And that's why it's really worth doing. So really, it's better to choose the way of Christ when you make your choices. As Haggai's going to explain to these people, when you go out to make your choices, make sure you choose the way of God or the way of Christ. Because the way of sin is very contagious in a community. You watch this in families or ecclesias. I used to watch this in teaching school all the time, that I'd get on an assignment. I'd tell the kids what we were going to do today, and all it took is one student right there to just say, I don't want to do that. Or especially when I was teaching math. It wasn't so much in science, because everybody loves science. But you're teaching math, and you get all done. You prove the quadratic equation, and you show how it works. And this guy comes up, and he said, what are we ever going to use that for? And it was true. What are they ever going to use that for? You're right. I had to look at it and say, you're probably right. You won't ever use that. But somebody in here might. And so it was part of the curriculum we had to teach. But see, science was never like that. Science is always applicable. But the key of the lesson is that sin is contagious like that. Look at how bad attitudes are so contagious in a group of people, in a group of young people. The bad attitude just spreads like crazy, and it's so hard to spread godliness. And that's what Haggai was trying to communicate to the people. He wanted them to be realistic and understand, just because Darius Hystaspes is in power right now and this window's opened up for you to get back to work, it's not going to be easy. You're going to have to fight your natural tendencies to want to stay home and work on your house or work on your farms and make more money and all that stuff, because all it takes is a few bad apples amongst the group. A little leaven can leaven the whole lump. And all of a sudden, that bad attitude spreads, and the people didn't want to do it. So Haggai leaves them then with something to consider. And God says, here's the challenge. You watch from today on. Consider from this day forward. From before the stone was laid in the temple of the Lord, since those days when one came to a heap of 20 ephahs, there were but 10. In other words, God didn't bless them economically because they weren't serious about getting the project done. 20 ephahs, only 10, because he had insects and he had mildew and he had mold that were eating away their produce. So he said in verse 17, I struck you with blight and mildew and hail and all the labors of your hands, yet you did not turn to me. See, God talked to them, but they weren't listening. I really believe Haggai's message for us today is listen. Listen when God talks to us. He talks to us through our health, through our economic situations, through our relationships that we have with each other. He is talking to us, and we just have to tune in and listen. So consider now from this day forward, from the 24th day of the 9th month, from the day that the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, consider it. Is the seed still in the barn? As yet the vine, the fig tree, the pomegranate, and the olive tree have not yielded their fruit. But from this day forward, I will bless you, because they were getting back to work. And Haggai came in to encourage the people, keep working, get the job done. And in 4 years, it's done. 4 more years, and they're done. And they'd worked on it for 16 years. But see, God's waiting for our commitment. That's what he wants out of all of us, is be committed to the work, go home, and get involved in our ecclesias. So the good news about our God is he really does love you, and he wants to bless you. That's what he really wants as he's training us to be part of his family. But when we make bad choices, he cannot do that. And so we've got to make sure we get involved. We go home to our families and our ecclesias, and we get involved in our CYCs and our Sunday schools and all our ecclesial activities. Show up for everything and get involved, because that's when God is happy with the kind of life we have. Now, Zechariah is going to come in at the same time. And Zechariah is going to give his prophecies. He's going to see, like, in one night, he's going to see 7 night visions. He's going to watch what happens. And he's going to be really encouraged to be able to come back to the people the next day and tell them, here's what I saw last night. You should have seen it. And he describes the visions for them to understand how God was working behind the scenes. His name means that Yah has remembered. He's introduced as the son of Berechiah, which is the blessings of Yahweh. And it's interesting to note that he's the grandson of Iddo, who was probably the same Iddo who returned with Zerubbabel. He's actually listed in Nehemiah 12, which means that Zechariah was probably a younger person. Haggai may have been the older one of the group. He's the one who gets the exhortations about challenging the people about their way of life. And then God uses the younger prophet to come in with enthusiasm and say, oh, you should have seen what I saw. Look at how the angels want to get this done. And they care more about it than we do. And look at how they're going to be out there like a wall of fire. And they promised us Joshua's going to be able to change his clothes and he's going to become our high priest. Joshua, the very fellow who's alive today, we're going to get this done. And this is how Zechariah came back to the people as a young person with all that enthusiasm. Now, if you've ever studied Zechariah's prophecies, I will warn you that when you look in our community, we don't all agree on Zechariah's prophecies. You can read the writings of various folks in our community, and you will see that we're a bit all over the table on some of these. I think it's fun to consider, though, that Zechariah's prophecies, as you're looking at this week, definitely had an original application. Don't lose sight of that. And that's what you want to focus on this week. You want to make sure, as you read through Zechariah next time, read it from the perspective of you're one of the captives. You've been working for 16 years after you came back and started working on this temple. The Persian king came in and said, no more working on it, you got to stop. And then the angels put in a new king, Darius Hystaspes, and you get the feeling like there's an opportunity. Maybe you can go back to work. Maybe we can work on the temple again. And so you do. You start working, and you're not sure whether God's going to bless it. And Zechariah comes in at that point and gives you all the encouragement you could ever ask for, that God's working behind the scenes to bless this effort. And then there is a future application of many of the prophecies of Zechariah, if not all. Because it was about a time when the Jews came back, when they returned from a captivity, and their goal was to rebuild the temple of God. Now, is that going to happen again? Is it? Sure it is. I mean, in our day, in these latter days, we expect the Jews to be regathered from all over the world. They're going to come back to Jerusalem, and the prophets say he's going to fill the land until there's no more room for them. And what are they going to do? They're going to build God's house. They're going to build Ezekiel's temple, and it will be built. And this will be the latter temple. This will be the glory of the latter house that Haggai talked about at that time. So sure, there's a latter-day application to most of these things, or what you might call a future application. Now, there was one good series of articles I found on this back in the Testimony magazines in 1985, because I became convinced years ago that this had to have a first application historically, and then we'll look at the latter one as well. And Edward Whitaker wrote some articles back in 1985, if you're interested in studying Zechariah's prophecies, where he did exactly that. He looked at the historical application, which he called the short term, and then he looked at the long-term application, which would have been one more towards the future. And it's really fun to examine them from that perspective. Now, you might think, well, what does it matter? But it does, because to understand Zechariah's prophecies, we have to first of all understand, what did it mean to these people? What did it mean to them? If you were one of these returned captives, and you were working for 16 years, and now you got back to working again, what would it mean to you? Because this motivated people to get involved in the work and to get the job done in 4 years. This was extremely encouraging to these people. And if you understand properly what it meant to them, then you have a basis for understanding what it means in the future. You don't just sit around and say, well, I think it means this, and well, I think it means that, because you have to connect it to, well, what did it mean the first time? And see, this is the good thing about Bible prophecy, about looking at the historical applications. It doesn't become a guess anymore about what the future means, because you build the future on the past. So when you get to Zechariah's prophecies and you see in chapter 1, four horsemen running around, and they come back and report to the guy under the myrtle tree, and then in Revelation, you read about the horsemen going out, the four horsemen. And you read, oh, there's horsemen in Revelation. There were horsemen back in Zechariah. And you start realizing, oh, yeah, maybe Zechariah helps you understand Revelation. Or you read about the horns in chapter 1 of Zechariah, and then you read about the beasts that have the horns on them in Revelation. Oh, maybe they're connected. Maybe there's something there. Or you read about the two olive trees in Zechariah 4. And then you come to Revelation 11. And what do you find? Ha! Huh, candlestick connected to two olive trees. Oh, that's interesting. Same basic idea. And you start connecting the fact that if you understand Zechariah, then you have a basis for understanding Revelation. Revelation isn't just grabbing things out of the sky and putting them into Revelation. Oh, no. Jesus Christ formed the Revelation on the basis of the Old Testament prophets. And he compiled things that they already were familiar with and put them into the Revelation. And so that's what you see. All of Daniel's beasts are back there in Revelation, and the components of those beasts are there. So he expects us to know Zechariah and Daniel really well in order for you to even begin to understand Revelation. You start in the Old Testament and work your way forward. And so it's a good strategy for understanding Bible prophecy. So where we're at right now then is we're in this second year of Darius Hystaspes. You're at that point right there where Haggai and Zechariah began to prophesy. This is Zechariah chapter 1. So in chapter 1, what you find is the first six verses are all about an exhortation to the people to get serious. Let's get serious and return back to the work. We've got to do that or else we may go captive again. You haven't learned the lesson of your fathers? You may have to go through and experience the consequences all over again. And then he shows the vision of the four horsemen. And then you have this encouragement that God will extend mercy to Jerusalem and build his house again. He will again choose Jerusalem. And then there's the vision of the four horns and the four craftsmen, or the four carpenters. That's basically chapter one. So what in the world is this about? So, in the beginning of this one, at the beginning of Zechariah chapter 1, you've got this message coming out about, return to me, says the Lord. If you return to me, because you know from Haggai what they've been doing. They've been out working on their homes, taking care of their yards and their gardens and their farms and trying to make a lot of money. They were into business pursuits and trying to economically build themselves up. So the message is, return to me and I will turn to you. I will be faithful. That's what God says. Turn from your evil ways, in verse 4. And he reminds them about what their parents and grandparents had done. Their grandparents years ago to cause the captivity in the first place. So it's always good to look back and realize, you know, that this is where we've come from. And the warning is there that if we return to those ways, we're going to return to the consequences. And so the people at this time, partly because of Haggai's message, it's already been laid out there for the people, their people now say, you're right. You're right. God is right. And you're right. And we look back and we realize and we consider how we fared, as Haggai said. We really now understand that you were talking to us. You were trying to get us back on track. We've made some mistakes and we're going to try to deal with those. And that's all God really wants from us when we make mistakes in life. And it's good for us to know that. So we go out and we commit some blunder. We go through the life of the prodigal son and we go out there and we do all that stuff and you come back to God, or somebody else in the community does, and they come back to God. Really, all he wants them to do is learn from that. That's what he's interested in. Learn from the mistakes and hope and pray that you don't make them again. That's what he's hoping, that we acknowledge those and that we deal with it. And now we're glad that he saved us out of it. So in the first vision, what he discovers in Zechariah chapter 1 is Zechariah sees this vision overnight. And he sees the man riding on a red horse. And he's standing amongst the myrtle trees. And amongst him are the red and the sorrel and the white horses behind. So you've got the horsemen that have come in. And what were they doing in Zechariah 1? They come back and they report to the angel who's under the myrtle trees. And they said, all right, we've been out patrolling the earth. We went out and did our job. You sent us out to patrol the earth, and now all the earth is at rest. That's what they've done. Now, remember where we are. We're at the point in history where the pseudo-Smyrtus had taken over. 7 months had gone by where the imposter was making decisions in the empire, and parts of the empire were rebelling, and he panicked. And when he heard the Jews were going to rebel, and that letter came, he made them by force stop the work. But other areas were rebelling as well. And then Darius Hystaspes takes over, and it took the angels a good year to bring the Persian Empire back under control. But they did. They brought it all back under control. They had instituted Darius Hystaspes as the leader of the world now, and all the Persian Empire was now at rest. And now they say to the man under the myrtle trees, we've done the job. We've done what you ask us to do. And now all the earth is brought at rest. In other words, we're ready. We did our part. How long are we going to wait? Now, when you look at the colored horses, when you look at what they represent, you can go back and see how they represented the different colored horses. Could represent war and famine and pestilence that were going on throughout the world. People that were rebelling, wars that were taking place. things that the angels had brought into the world to bring them under control. They probably brought droughts and pestilence and so on. And so when you see that happening here in Zechariah, then that gives you a basis for understanding the horsemen later on in Revelation. The key is to understand that although it means a connected item and it's got a similar use, it doesn't mean the exact same thing. Now, let's say that again. It's connected. When you read Revelation, it's connected because it means something similar, but it's not about the exact same event, because Zechariah was happening way back at this time, way back in B.C., what, 500, 400 something B.C., and the Revelation is happening much further in the future. But it's the same angels out there patrolling the earth, controlling things, organizing events, and controlling the destiny of the nations. That's what they have in common. So when somebody read Revelation and they understood how the angels were involved in Zechariah's time, you'd read Revelation then and realize, oh, wow, there's the angels again. They're out there organizing and controlling world events. And that's what you would connect. The myrtle tree that they come back and report to the man who's standing under the myrtle tree. It's used to represent in the Bible and amongst other people. It was an evergreen. So it would be one of those plants that even in the midst of our drought, it would be sitting out there with green leaves doing just fine. And it would survive, you know, in winters and cold, and it would survive the droughts. And it seemed to represent to the people the idea of endurance and stability and therefore peace that they were going to bring, that these angels had brought. It's possible it may be even connected to Esther, because Esther's name means myrtle in Hadassah. When you look at Hadassah in the Hebrew. And these angels that had brought the earth under control and were working in world events, right about this exact time, they're setting up the scenario to have Vashti removed out of the kingdom from being queen and introducing the possibility of bringing Esther in as the queen. And it's just fun to watch some of those events. Those of you that are doing the timeline would start to see how these events start to connect. So Esther's going to become queen, setting up the time period for God to bless the Jews and for Nehemiah's return and so on. So that's what the myrtle trees actually look like. We wouldn't really consider them a tree anymore today. We'd probably call them a bush, but they can grow up fairly large and then they lose some of their branches down below. So it's possible you can get up as tall as 15 feet and they might be able to ride the horses in between. Now, who are the horsemen? Right? These are the ones whom the Lord has sent, it says in verse 10, to walk to and fro throughout the earth. They've been out there walking to and fro throughout the earth. Now, have you heard that phrase before? To and fro throughout the earth? Like the eyes of the Lord? Remember Asa, when he had made his mistake? The prophet came in and he said to him, look it, the eyes of the Lord are out there going to and fro throughout the whole earth to show themselves strong on behalf of those who worship Yahweh, who fear Yahweh. That's what he was supposed to learn. So he wouldn't have trusted in his little scheme to work with Baasha, the king of Israel. And so that's the connection that you say in walking to and fro throughout the earth. These seven eyes you find in Zechariah's prophecy in chapter 4 at verse 10. When he talks about the eyes that are on the stone from chapter 3, Zechariah tells us in chapter 4 that these seven eyes that have been looking at the capstone in chapter 3, these seven eyes are the eyes of the Lord which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth. And so Zechariah gives us hints as you go through his prophecy that what these are the angels. These are the angels that are out there where God sets up the game plan and says, look it, we got to bring the Persian Empire back under control. And they go out there and they do the work. And they organize events to have that happen. Probably did the same thing with Vashti, and they're controlling those events. So these were the angels that were out there working, bringing about the political events so that everything was right to finish this temple. And they got excited about their project. They had installed Darius Hystaspes as the king. They put down all these rebellions in the Persian Empire caused by the pseudo-Smerdis, Gomedes, all his takeover. And now they brought the earth back to rest. It was resting quietly. And they suppressed the adversaries in Ezra chapter 4 that we were just looking at in some of the previous classes in Ezra. So, you know, what the people hadn't seen, honestly, the folks that were having trouble getting on board with this temple, because no prophet had shown up And because there wasn't some angel that just walked in and talked to the community or talked to the leader like he had with Moses, the people missed the fact, they had not understood that these angels were organizing and orchestrating events so that you could get the job done. If you look in Ezra chapter 5, after the adversaries wrote the letter again, and then the king Darius Hystaspes responds back, look at what the angels accomplished for these people that were willing to get out there and do the work. Remember how God said in Haggai, from this day forward, you watch, I'm going to bless you. And you wonder, like, how could he bless us economically so that all of a sudden just a bunch of money pours in? How can that happen? Well, God said, you watch, from this day forward, I'm going to bless you. You're going to have plenty to eat, and you're going to have plenty of money. And you watch how I'll do that. So when the letter came back from Darius Hystaspes in Ezra 5, he said to all those adversaries around that had been causing all that trouble, he said, keep yourselves far from there. You're not allowed to go near that temple anymore. Let the work of this house of God alone. You know, don't bother those Jews anymore. Let them get the work done. And look at verse 8. Let the cost be paid from the king's expense from taxes. So all those taxes they were collecting all around the lands we would call today Lebanon and Jordan and Edom, you know, down in the south and Saudi Arabia and Egypt, all the money that the king was collecting from those areas and sending back over to the Persian Empire, he says, all right, from now on, some of those taxes you guys pay me are going to go to finish this temple. And God, he had them pay for the temple. It's fascinating to watch how this worked out. But it was because they trusted God to take care of the house. They trusted God to take care of the defenses. And God says, I'll do that. I'll send the angels to take care of that. You just get working in my spiritual house. You get building, all right, and I'll take care of the rest. And verse 9 just says the general, like, whatever else they need. You need anything else? Let it be taken care of. Let it be given to them day by day without fail. This was far more than they could have ever expected. And it was because they got back to work. So the angels come in Zechariah chapter 1, and look at how they talk. It's really fun to watch how the angels report back to the man under the myrtle tree, and they talk to him. And that angel talks to another angel, and that angel talks to God. And he says to God, and yet, how long are you going to wait? See, the angels don't know the exact game plan. They know some of the specifics, but they don't know when exact events are going to happen. And so they did their job. They brought the earth back under control because they realized this was something we had to do before the war could get going again. And then they say to God, how long are you going to wait before you choose Jerusalem again? How long? And God comes back and says, you know, yeah, I was angry at the nations, all right? And I'm gonna be angry at the nations that have caused this trouble in verse 15. I'm going to show mercy to Jerusalem, comes back the report. And God's house will be built in verse 16. And he will again choose Jerusalem. He comes back with comforting words to the angel. But I really think it's fun to watch in Zechariah how angels go out and do a job. They report back into a higher angel. That angel in turn asks another angel because there is hierarchy amongst the angels. And this is the hope that we have, young people. You're going to be equal to the angels. You're going to work in a community of heavenly beings and be joined in with their work. And there's going to be people that are way up there, and they're going to know the bigger game plan than we do. And there's going to be people under them and people under them. And some of us will only know bits and pieces about what we do from day to day. And we'll be trying to figure it out like puzzle pieces. How's this going to work out? Like the angels that longed to look into the things of the prophets, that the prophets had spoken. And they didn't understand how to put the pieces together about Christ dying and the Gentiles coming in. These were things they were trying to figure out. Don't think that when you become an angel, equal to the angels, you're going to just know everything all of a sudden. It's not going to be like that. You're going to know what you need to know. And God is going to keep life very interesting for you. And that's part of what brings the interest. We try to figure those things out. We have those kind of minds that are inquisitive, and we're trying to work out what God is doing. So when you look at the lesson for us out of that, is look, we got to get involved in God's work today, and we got to stay involved even in the tough times, and don't forget the angels are there to help us. So then the second vision comes up in Zechariah chapter 1. And what does he see this time? He sees the four horns. And the four horns are representing powers. And these powers have been causing trouble to the Jews. They had so much trouble that they had been adversaries against them. They had written letters to try to get them to stop. They had tried to discourage the people. They had been involved in, like, finally in the end, the Persian government had come in and made them stop by force. And then he sees four craftsmen, or carpenters in the King James. And what happens is that the horns had scattered and humiliated Israel. Yeah, they had suppressed you. They had caused you all kinds of trouble. But God says that what he is going to do is use four craftsmen. Craftsmen. People that had been working on the temple. The craftsmen. The ones who were forging things for the temple. The stone cutters for the temple. The ones who were the workers of the temple. And he says, look, you guys that are like, you just think you're temple workers. And you're just building stones upon stones and putting together my house. I'm going to use you fellas to terrify those powers that have been causing you all this trouble. And you read through the story of Ezra, and that's exactly what he did. Because he had installed a new king. Now Darius Hystaspes is there. He supports the work, finds Cyrus's decree, and he says, look it, you adversaries, let him alone. You're done. You leave this temple alone. And instead, you pay for it. And this, it's sort of fun to watch that in this vision that God had now said, it's okay, I'm going to take care of you. Because the people were worried. They were worried that the Persians were going to come in again and stop them. So you go back and look at how the horns were used through history. And in these visions, in Daniel's visions, they're used about powers. So when you get to Revelation and you see animals that have horns on them, that's what you expect them to be. These were four kings probably responsible for scattering Israel. And you could look back, and if you want to identify them, some people have identified them with Shalmaneser, Sennacherib, Pharaoh Necho, Nebuchadnezzar, all different kings that had been involved in scattering the Jews over the last 150 years or so, almost 200 years. But it's possible that the four horns may just, in the same way you can have like north, south, east, and west, that the four horns may not actually refer to specific things as much as they were trying to say, look at all of them in every direction. All the adversaries that have been causing you trouble today, I promise you that I'm going to use all of you craftsmen, the four craftsmen representing the temple builders. I'm going to use you to get this job done, and you are going to terrify those horns because they're going to be afraid of the Jews. They're going to be afraid of you because of what the Persian king is going to say. Leave them alone. Don't stop the work. Don't get involved. Don't even go up there and cause them trouble. You pay for it, but don't go there and bother them. Because now the fear of the Jews was falling on the Gentiles. And it's fun to watch how that worked. And it continued. Oh, it continues into the story of Esther. Because what happened in the story of Esther? After Haman's plan failed, then the nations, the Gentile nations, began to fear the Jews. And many of them, it says, even joined to the Jews in those days because they were afraid of the Jews. And see, this was God's promise. You just get working, you do the job, and I will protect you. And you carpenters, you craftsmen, you temple builders, you are going to suppress those nations around you, and you are going to have them afraid of you. So it's possible, at least, that that's what this was going after. And you actually, when you go back and you look at some of the evidence that's there, in Ezra chapter 3, it's fun to look at the fact that they gave the money to the masons and the carpenters. That's actually the same word back there. These were the people that were building on the temple. They were temple workers. And God's prediction was that he was going to use those temple workers to overcome these foreign powers. Now, have you noticed in reading through Haggai and Zechariah, Uncle Mike was just talking to me about it before, about how there's the use of the phrase, the Lord of hosts. It's all over in Haggai and in Zechariah, and you'll see it in Malachi. And you wonder, like, why is this phrase there so often? You can compare that back in Isaiah, that's about 60 times the phrase Yahweh of armies, Lord of hosts. In Jeremiah, it's there about 80 times. But Isaiah's 66 books, Jeremiah's 50-some chapters. In the story of Zechariah, it occurs 50 times in 14 chapters. And you wonder, like, what is God trying to do? Look at Malachi, how often he kept using, thus says the Lord of hosts, Yahweh of armies. Because he wanted to give the people an assurance that the armies of the Lord, the angels, were there, out there working on your behalf, and they will accomplish God's will. And so he keeps reminding them with that phrase, Lord of hosts, the Lord of hosts. Yahweh of armies, the one who will be revealed through the armies, the angelic armies that are out there working for you, they are going to take care of you, and they will be there to protect your people. And certainly you'll find that the nations did learn that. You see that in Esther chapter 6. Remember that the warning started coming through with Haman and his family, and they realized in verse 13, Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him about Mordecai and what had happened with what's going on. And his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him." And the fear of the Jews began to fall upon those people. This is what angels can do behind the scenes. So then you have the last vision we'll look at this morning, the one, the third vision. And this is the one where you have the man with the measuring line. And what he does is he goes out there to measure Jerusalem. And so what happens? This man gets all excited, the building projects, right? And he runs out there with his measuring line, and he's going to measure the whole city to build the walls. Because after the Persians had come in and made them stop by force, and all these adversaries were working against them, the thought came up against the people when we get back to work, we shouldn't be building the temple. We should go finish the walls. We should do what Nehemiah is going to do later on. You know, they didn't realize that then, but they're thinking, walls, we need defenses, we need protection. And so God handles that problem. He anticipates what they're going to think. And so the man goes out there with the measuring line to measure Jerusalem to build the walls, and another angel comes out, and the angel says to him, "Hey, go over and stop that young man over there. Stop him and say, you don't need to do this. You don't need to worry about the walls, because Jerusalem's going to become overflowing with people and livestock, and God will be the wall of fire and the glory all around her. Don't worry about the walls. You get the temple finished, and God will protect the city." And so that it makes so much sense when you follow the flow of these visions. Now, if you're reading the Green Book or the Red Book from H.P. Mansfield, some of you may notice that he took the approach in this of this vision of thinking that it had something to do with destruction and that he was measuring Jerusalem for it to be destroyed. But it doesn't flow within the chapters. And so what you see is that they needed encouragement. They needed an understanding that God will protect us. We can keep working on the temple. We just have to do our job. And so you'll find that that was very encouraging to those Jews. There are only about 40,000 of them back in the land right now. And the adversaries have been discouraging them. They'd hired counselors against them. The Persian king only 2 years ago had come in and made them stop by force. And so Yahweh of armies lets them know, you keep working, and I'll use you carpenters to destroy and terrify those horns, and I will be the wall of fire that protects you. You just have to trust me. And so God says, you don't need walls right now. I'm going to bless this city so that so many people are going to come in that you're going to have all these people and all these animals, and I will be the wall of fire. But to understand that, young people, it took a vision of faith. You had to be able to look to the future and realize, I only have to do my part right now and do what God has asked. Get the temple built and trust God to take care of the rest. And I really believe in our lives today that if we do that, if we trust God to take care of those other components, He will do it. He'll take care of us economically. He'll make sure that we end up in the right families. He'll make sure that we have a job, and He'll take care of all those things if you go home and get involved in building His spiritual house. That's the kind of thing He's asking out of us today. We got to do that. And so later on in chapter 2, the message goes out in chapter 2 of Zechariah, and the warning goes out not from the captives, but for the ones that were in the land, but the warning goes out way up to those Jews who never came back. And the warning is, get out of Babylon while you can. You better get out now. And little did they know that Haman's plot was coming. And yet the warning had been there all along. You better get out. You better get out. And look at the problem that they had. Look at the trouble Ezra had getting anybody to come back with him. The Jews that were up in Babylon had done what Jeremiah said. They had built houses, they had planted vineyards, they'd settled in and had families, and they were very comfortable up in Babylon. And now the window opened for them to return, and many of them didn't want to come back. And so they're warning them that God's going to shake His hand against the nations. And what He's hoping is that through all of those events, many nations will be joined to the Lord, and God will end up dwelling in their midst. But right now, only about 42,000 Jews had actually come back, and only a few of them, and only 74 of those were Levites. And then later on, when Ezra tried to get the people to come back, he couldn't even find any Levites when he first gathered at the river. And he had to go ask and request some of the Levites would come back with them, because they were very happy up there in Babylon. So when you look at, well, why wouldn't they want to go back? Why would they want to stay up there? Well, it was a lot easier to stay in Persia. Life was better up there for them. They weren't slaves, but they had good lives up there. It's a long hike. You know, you're looking at a long journey. It's probably more like, if you're going to take the river route, almost 1,000 miles to get back. The land of Israel was a mess. It really was a mess. You know, you look at what had gone on in the community back then when the land was laid waste. It was going to take a lot of work to get the farms going again. And if they heard reports about the time period right now, they would know that God had sent drought. There was mildew in the land, eating up their crops. And the Levites, oh, you wonder, why didn't the Levites want to come back? They were the well-educated. They had good jobs up in Babylon. Would you want to go back down to Israel and trust the people to provide you with food? I don't think so. Because what happened as soon as Nehemiah left? What happened to the poor Levites? Nehemiah leaves after 12 years. In the 32nd year, he goes back up to the king of Persia. And immediately, Eliashib, the high priest, takes the big storeroom in the temple where you were supposed to bring the tithes for the Levites, and he turns it over to Tobiah. And the Levites scattered out of the area, the temple area, and went back to their lands, because there's no way they could support themselves anymore. That's how quickly things turn around. And they realize, ooh, we're not going back down to Israel. They may not take care of us. And so they didn't want to make the move, and it required faith on their hand. But God promised that he would bless the people. He promised to protect their cities. He promised that he would dwell in their midst in Zechariah 2. And then he raised up Haman to give them the push. So you start to see how these events are all connected. To the Jews that didn't respond and wouldn't go back right now, God raises up a Haman to say, look it, you better seriously consider. You thought you were okay up there in Babylon? You were going to be the first guys to die if Haman's plan had gone through. You better get out of Babylon. And he gives them that push. It's also fun to look at in Ezra chapter 6, that prediction in Zechariah that when God works all this out, that in the end, many nations are going to be drawn. Do you realize it had an initial fulfillment back there in Ezra chapter 6? A good thing to Bible mark. Because when the children of Israel came together, who had returned from the captivity, when they came from the captivity, they ate together in Ezra 6 with all who had separated themselves from the filth of the nations of the land in order to seek Yahweh Elohim of Israel. There were Gentiles who were influenced by all of the things happening, and they were drawn into the community, and they wanted to worship Yahweh, the God of Israel. It's really fun to watch. In the same way some of the Egyptians saw the plagues, and they went out with Israel in the end, now we have Gentiles living in the land who are just watching the things that are happening, and they're realizing, wow, this God has power. He pulled strings for them that, whew, how did that ever happen? We got to leave them alone now in the temple? They're allowed to build it? We got to pay for it? And all of a sudden, they were creeping into the Jewish community and joining themselves. And so that's why in verse 22, if you read carefully, it said they kept the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with joy. That was the joyous feast that they were having, for the Lord had made them joyful and turned the heart of the king of Assyria toward them. This is what had happened now, is they're allowed to finish the building to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel, because so many Gentiles were coming in and were now being a part of the God of Israel. They were being joined, and they were keeping the feast of unleavened bread, and they were celebrating with the Jews and recognizing that the God of Israel is the one who was doing it. So it's just fun to watch that. You'll see that in Zechariah as well, in Zechariah 8, when it talked about peoples that were going to come, and that many peoples and strong nations were going to be joined to the Lord. And in those days, he predicted that 10 men from every language of the nations would grasp the sleeve of a Jewish man saying, let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. A big part of this was witnessing. So this morning, at least, in some of the lessons from the first three visions of Zechariah, let's remember that God does love us. He really does, and he wants to bless us when we make good choices, as Haggai had said. Don't forget, he can use the craftsmen, the ecclesial workers today. You don't have to be a genius. You don't have to be super skilled in something of this life. He can use all of you ecclesial workers to accomplish his work. We just have to get involved and volunteer. And while we're doing that, God will protect his ecclesias. He'll protect you. He'll provide for you what you really need. He'll provide homes and food and clothing, the things you really need, he will give you. And don't forget to flee out of Babylon. As that message was there, get out of Babylon while you can, because the day may come when you can't leave Babylon, and those that are in Babylon still will be destroyed with Babylon before the great and the terrible day of the Lord. And of all things out of Zechariah, don't forget, the angels are there. They're here today. They're going with you back home to your families and ecclesias. And they're watching over all of your ecclesial work, all of the situations of your life. And they're going to make sure that God's spiritual house, his family, is assembled in the kingdom. And what they're doing right now is training you to join them in the work of God for eternity, when you're allowed to join with the four living ones and the 24 elders of Revelation 5, and you worship the king at that time. And all of God's family is finally assembled together. So you're going to see, those are some of the fun things that pop up in Zechariah, and we'll hopefully finish Zechariah's visions tomorrow. And with that, you get to enjoy some lunch and then go to the beach. Thanks.